loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Russiagate has now morphed into a fundamental assault on free speech and dissent, as U.S. government officials of both parties have insisted at Senate hearings that Facebook and other social media platforms work with the FBI and other police agencies to monitor and shut down so-called socially divisive posts and pages and websites that they say promote, quote, extremist views. And the Senate starts to ponder even greater, what they call crushing, economic sanctions against Russia. And then we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and just how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, The Intercept reported today that former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was fired thanks to pressure from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Tillerson had intervened to mediate those countries' dispute with neighboring Qatar. Saudi Arabia had intended to invade and conquer Qatar with UAE help. Next, the Trump administration this morning announced that it was freezing fuel efficiency requirements for all cars and trucks through 2026 as part of a dramatic rollback of Obama-era environmental regulations. The announcement comes on the heels of a weakening of air and water quality regulations. Then, Israel has blocked the delivery of fuel and gasoline to the besieged Gaza Strip, saying that it was in retaliation for Palestinians setting fire to Israeli land with flaming kites. Only cooking gas, wheat, and flour will be allowed into Gaza until further notice. And then Pope Francis announced this morning that the death penalty is inadmissible under any circumstances and that the church will work toward its abolition around the world. The announcement marks an evolution of the Catholic Church's official view of the death penalty that began under Pope John Paul II in 1978. And finally, the Trump administration has imposed sanctions on the justice and interior ministers of Turkey in retaliation for the continued incarceration of American pastor Andrew Brunson. Brunson was arrested 2 years ago and charged with espionage for preaching. He has yet to go to trial. Turkish President Erdogan said the move will jeopardize longstanding U.S.-Turkish relations and that Ankara will consider retaliatory sanctions. And in other headlines, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia launched airstrikes on the Yemeni city of Hodeidah today, killing between 26 and 40 people. One strike targeted the main gate of a hospital, leaving 50 people in critical condition. Hodeidah is a port city and is the main port in Yemen, where 8.4 million people are currently at risk of starvation if the port ceases operation. Apple is the first publicly traded company ever to reach a value of $1 trillion. It announced today in its third quarter results, where it also reported a $20 billion buyback of its own shares, that is, using company profits to buy company stock, driving up the price and giving dividends to company executives who own that stock. The National Archives has informed Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley that it will not be able to provide all of its documents related to the career of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. 300,000 pages of documents will be available by mid-August, but an additional 600,000 pages are not expected to be ready until October. Supporters of Kavanaugh have been pressing to confirm him before the midterm election, while opponents are urging a delay in the vote until all documents are released. Several Pakistani political parties will reportedly field a candidate for prime minister together to oppose Imran Khan. The Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, or PMLN, and the Pakistan People's Party, or Triple P, two larger parties in Pakistan, will join with other smaller parties to form the All Parties Conference as the primary opposition alliance. Khan's party, the Pakistan Party for Justice, recently won 116 of the 272 elected seats in the National Assembly, and Khan has become president. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Yesterday, it heard testimony from social media and technology experts who said companies like Facebook, Google, and Twitter must, quote, do more, close quote, to prevent the spread of disinformation or misinformation and foreign propaganda. But where does one draw the line between that and freedom of speech? Are Americans in danger of losing civil liberties? We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She is a constitutional lawyer and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. And we're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Mara and Jim, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks for having me.
Mara, let's start with you. We are now sort of entering a new phase, a new stage of the so-called Russiagate probe, the Mueller probe, whereby the U.S. political leadership, both parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans, in this case in the Senate, insisting, in fact, that Facebook, working with entities like the Atlanta Council and the FBI and other government agencies, do more, as they put it, to police people's exercise of their free speech, or maybe it's not free speech, just speech. I mean, we've entered a new phase. Go ahead.
Well, what we've seen recently and now with this week's headlines is an overt effort by government officials and by law enforcement, intelligence, and military agencies, really, to control the political discourse on social media. And the way that this is being carried out is with Facebook's announcement that it had what it refers to as, quote-unquote, bad actors on Facebook that must be removed. They identified these bad actors by working directly with their, what they refer to as their partner, the Atlantic Council, who, in their words, helps them identify abuse on Facebook and helps them identify bad actors. And, of course, the Atlantic Council has a board of directors of Henry Kissinger, Michael Hayden, Michael Morell, Chertoff, David Petraeus, James Woolsey. I mean, the you name it list of America's CIA and military leadership. And now they're looking at postings on social media and making a determination as to whether or not these postings are appropriate or whether, in their view, they are sowing division in America, which means anyone that is raising critical issues of social injustice, of racial injustice, issues related to women's liberation, immigration, or as most recently happened over the last 48 hours, opposition to the Nazis and fascists who plan to march in Washington, D.C. in about 10 days, that those words and those points of view are now being censored by Facebook.
Yeah, Jim Kavanaugh, let me read to you from Reuters. The Senate Intelligence Committee has called executives of Facebook, Twitter, Alphabet, Google, Google's parent company, to testify on September 5th, quote, to hear the plans that they have in place to press them to do more and to work together to address this challenge. All the evidence this committee has seen to date suggests that the platform companies, namely Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Google, and YouTube, still have a lot of work to do, Warner said. I mean, how is this not the government interfering directly and telling privately owned or publicly owned media platforms what they can say, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate? How is that not a flagrant intervention by the government in violation of basic cherished free speech rights?
Well, I think it is, but I mean, these organizations are compliant with this. They're succumbing to this and they're agreeing to it. And what they're doing is they're defining themselves, Facebook and Google, as, you know, arms of the Washington consensus. They are going to police, as you say, the Washington consensus. These are the fora now where people talk to each other and also where they get their news. I think 70% of the news or 80% of the news now people get from Facebook and Google. So what they're doing is they're saying to the government, okay, we will act as you wish. And through organizations, you know, the paragovernmental organizations like the Atlanta Council, which represents NATO and the Washington consensus, you know, we are going to try and we are going to agree with you that the only permissible limits of discourse are within certain parameters that are really very narrow that we've all seen for the last 20, 30 years. You know, this is market democracy and American liberalism and what we're calling radical centrism. You know, and anything out of the range of that, we're going to define as divisive, which what does that mean? It means that your opposition to the dominant policies. It means that you have a radical critique of some kind of the dominant situation, whether it's the Trump administration, whether it's just disagreement. I mean, between white nationalists, and you're going to oppose them, you're going to want to abolish ICE. Oh, that's outrageous. You know, this is something. But beyond that, they're saying all of this that's going on Facebook, that really must be from the Kremlin. What it's doing is setting up a situation where everybody now who has these radical critiques or any kind of critique that could be defined as divisive has to start out by assuring everybody they're not a Kremlin agent, which is ridiculous.
Mara, go ahead. I mean, I think Jim is right, and that's what we're saying. I mean, what they're basically saying, what it boils down to now, is that even if you're not getting your orders from the Kremlin, if you're promoting, let's say, a progressive agenda against Nazis or the Klan or in support of Black Lives or against police violence, you might be an unwitting stooge of a congruent agenda because it's the Kremlin's agenda to, quote, weaken America by promoting socially divisive issues. I mean, and it goes, Mara, as you know, and as I've heard you speak about, it goes straight back to the first Cold War, where the civil rights movement was labeled just an agent of communism or an agent of outside agitators. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, in fact, that's the language that they're using, right? They're talking about people are furthering the outside state actors' efforts, either wittingly or unwittingly. And it is very much the language or the modern language of the Cold War. It's the same as saying people are engaged in, quote, un-American activities, that people are engaged in, quote, subversive activities. And this is the language they're using now, which is sow division, inflame social tensions. That's what we're seeing constantly in the headlines for the first, you know, the last 48 hours. NBC wrote this story up with a headline saying, Senate Intel Committee grapples with social media's threat to democracy. And then you have Mark Warner saying today's disclosure is further evidence that the Kremlin continues to exploit platforms like Facebook to sow division and spread disinformation. Well, take that sentence apart. First of all, Facebook said that they couldn't identify this and say that they believe that this was coming from Russia, let alone the Kremlin, which is just euphemistic for anything that they believe is identified related back to Russia. And when he says sow division and spread disinformation, well, what exactly about any of these postings was spreading disinformation? Facebook made the postings visible. One is a rally that was an existing rally that was taking place, is taking place, will take place in opposition to the Nazis and the fascists bringing their message to Washington, D.C. And that was happening no matter what, yet Facebook identifies it as if that was a rally in opposition that's created by outside actors, when, of course, it's not created by outside actors. And then they said they took the event down and notified the unwitting participants, which is the people that were helping organize the anti-fascist rally. And when you're talking about disinformation, I mean, many of the postings are just straightforward statements in support of Black liberation, women's liberation, indigenous rights. None of that is, quote-unquote, disinformation, but it doesn't matter to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and it doesn't matter to the people that are promoting this, and frankly, will be feeding at the trough of that huge amount of money that is going to go into hiring consultants and entities to police social media. And Facebook itself says it's working with the FBI. So now you have the government and these other entities directly partnering with social media giants, where there is this huge platform of speech where people can communicate, can organize. And I think that this is a direct effort to change the ability of the people of the United States to be able to organize, to be able to speak out in mediums that don't require them to buy $100,000 page ads in the Washington Post.
If I could interrupt you for 1 second, I want to toss this to Jim Kavanaugh, too. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, said that the FBI has seen no indications that there are Russian attacks on voting infrastructure or vote counts, but that there was an ongoing media influence campaign that isn't even necessarily tied to the election.
It's about weakening America now.
Yeah,
is this
right.
Generic weakening
exactly.
America?
And the thing is they keep moving the goal line. The people in the FBI and in the Congress and elsewhere around government, they keep moving the goal line and they keep changing the parameters of this debate. One of the things that's the most disappointing to me, and I want Jim to comment on it, is the fact that it's the Democrats who are at the front of the line here. People like Mark Warner, who are the most likely to attack the Russians, to attack outside forces, and to just take the CIA's and FBI's word for it when they offer up these broad conclusions without providing any evidence.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's Warner, whom Mara just quoted. I was going to make that same quote. And Adam Schiff, I mean, these people are adamant about this, and they're very nasty. As you say, it's gone from change the election outcome, interfere in the elections, to spread division, sow division and divisiveness and spread disinformation, to influence. I mean, what are you talking about? People are making their points of view known. It's really kind of everything. It becomes one big cloud, night in which all disagreement is gray and all disagreement ends up being Kremlin red in some way, even though, oh, we can't really, you know, there is no evidence this was the Kremlin, but some of this was these kind of fortune cookie aphorisms from Mindful Matter, you know, about everybody's have a nice day. And these were supposed to be Kremlin influenced something. I don't know. So, but everybody's now being put in a position of having to be shamed in advance about sowing division. And you have to beg, you have to claim, you know, make sure you say, oh, I'm not Kremlin agent, but it's the have you now or were you ever a Kremlin troll?
Go ahead, Mara.
Well, it sounds like it's just those ones that Jim's pointing out. I mean, it's like the Kremlin, I guess, is cornering the market, because on one hand they're inflaming social division, and on the other hand they're encouraging people to meditate and kind of chill out.
So, yeah, indeed.
You know, they got everything down. But, you know, there was one of the guys that they brought in to testify, John Kelly, a founder of Graphica. These people that were brought in to testify that really are just, you know, poised to and are already probably making a large amount of money over this created threat to American democracy. But he said automated accounts at the far left and far right of the American political spectrum generate as many as 25 to 30 times the number of messages that genuine political accounts put out on an average day. And he said this results in extremists' messages screaming while the majority whispers, which I think really defines where they're at. They're going to say, what are appropriate political views? What are appropriate political messages? Anything beyond, outside, and around what we're allowed to hear on CNN day in and day out, or Fox News on day in and day out, is going to be considered extremist, sowing division, and therefore a tool of foreign powers to sow division in the United States. They're speaking very directly, as you were saying, to the fact that this is an ever-shifting ball game. I mean, they're always sort of hiding the cards, moving it. You don't know at one moment to the next what they're going to claim the origin of the threat is, and it morphs according to whatever they need and whatever they have in front of them. So now the threat is, of course, just that it weakens America if people in America are engaged in speaking out and in dissent.
Indeed. That's the voice of Mara Verheyden-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund here in Washington, D.C. She's a constitutional rights lawyer. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has done enormous work defending the rights of protesters, the rights of dissent. We're also speaking with Jim Kavanaugh, who is with thepolemicist.net. Jim, I know you want to jump in. Let me just read a sentence or two to you from Mark Warner's testimony from yesterday. And I think it says a lot about where it's going and what the threat actually is. Over the past year and a half, Senator Richard Burr and I have led the Senate Intelligence Committee's bipartisan investigation into Russia's attack on the 2016 election, uncovering the unprecedented ways Russia abused social media to divide Americans against each other and undermine our democratic process. In many ways, our intelligence community was caught off guard by this new threat. Now, the Trump administration, the Trump campaign in 2016, spent $90 million on Facebook and social media ads and had a very, very sophisticated campaign, very micro-targeting voters or likely voters, collecting the data on 220 million people, having data points, 4,000 to 5,000 data points on most of those people, and then connecting them to like-minded or people who might have similar views. There was this enormous effort. And Obama had a big social media effort in 2008 and 2012, which was heralded as a great new electioneering device at the time, if you remember. But the indictments by Mueller of the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, the St. Petersburg trolling farm, that was based on the fact that they spent $80,000 on ads, most of which were not about the elections, and 56% of which came after November 8th, 2016. And yet, when you read this kind of language, the intelligence communities were caught off guard by this unprecedented threat. The only conclusion one must come to is that we must fund the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. We must enlarge their powers. We must make sure that they've protected us from this kind of menace in the future. It's really about creating a police state where Democrats and people who in the past or maybe still do think of themselves as liberals say, yes, we must. Yes, we must. I mean, therein lies, I would say, the fundamental danger.
Yeah, I mean, this campaign that they're talking about in the Times says the accounts ran 150 ads costing $11,000. And that was the jolting disclosure. And a lot of those, as we said, were these mindful, mind at rest ads. Had nothing to do with politics even. But and the Democrats are pouring into this, and they're using it as a platform to strengthen intelligence community and police, FBI, CIA oversight of American political discourse. This is kind of nuts. And I want to say one other thing we should mention here. As this is going on, the real danger to free speech that's coming is the possibility of Julian Assange being extradited and brought to trial in the United States. And the media outlets in the United States, who are not just Democrats, but the New York Times and the Washington Post, who are 100% behind this, oh, we got to do something about the Kremlin influence in Facebook for $111,000, and are saying nothing about the threat that's going on that would be really dangerous to free speech and the free press if Julian Assange is brought to the United States for trial.
Amara Verhaeghe-Hilliard, I'm also noticing that six U.S. senators, in the face of what they say are now obvious Russian efforts to interfere in the 2018 election, have introduced a new sanctions bill that would target Russia's sovereign debt, meaning, I believe, that Russia buys American securities and American bonds, then those would be frozen. Lindsey Graham says, because the current sanctions regime has failed to deter Russia from meddling in the upcoming 2018 midterm elections, our goal is to change the status quo and impose crushing sanctions and other measures against Putin's Russia, against Putin who owns all of Russia, until he ceases and desists meddling in the U.S. electoral process, halts cyber attacks on U.S. infrastructure, removes Russia from Ukraine, and ceases efforts to create chaos in Syria. Well, that would mean, of course, that there would be no possible way that Russia could avoid these sanctions when you talk about all of those multitude of issues. So we're talking about an assault, it seems to me, Mara, on free speech rights, at the same time as we have a bipartisan emerging consensus that's, I would say a super hawkish foreign policy, but maybe that's, an insult to hawks. I mean, go ahead.
Well, that was woven in repeatedly during yesterday's hearings and the discourse from elected officials about the Facebook announcement. And they were saying over and over again, and they're quote-unquote experts, well, these guys are all just self-appointed experts, were coming in and saying what has to happen here is not only having partnership with law enforcement to oversee social media, to help identify, incorrect words on social media, basically, and incorrect political speech, but that there has to be a hard and fast response against Russia, against state actors, on the assumption and determination that these guys are making that Russia is responsible for these postings that Facebook just took down, even though Facebook says that they can't make that connection. So they were rushing to say very quickly and to weave that in absolutely affirmatively that there should be sanctions, that there should be punishment, that there should be a response. But, it begs the question, response to what? They can't say and don't know, and Facebook is not saying that, in fact, this has anything to do with Russia. And then, of course, stepping back to what is the this anyway, because the this was nothing.
Jim Kavanaugh, go ahead, Jim.
Mara made another good point previously, which I think is important, that this is creating a, an industry for the like the terrorism experts who all popped up after 9/11. This is now you're going to have the cyber threat, the cyber social media threat experts who are going to be, you know, hired by every network to be commentators. And part of this legislation for the sanctions, according to The Hill, says it would create a State Department Office of Cyberspace and the Digital Economy, create a national fusion center to respond to hybrid threats. So they're creating, again, more organizations that are going to be policing discourse and policing activities and, you know, creating little careers for people in this and little sinecures for them to be experts on Russian threat. And this is going to, you know, proliferate throughout the political discourse of the country.
Mara, does it seem similar to you? We had the last 15 years where anti-terrorism authorities and budgeting were used by fusion centers to attack the Occupy movement and peaceful protesters. Now maybe that's worn thin, the war on terror, so we need a new war, maybe a war against Russia. Again, building careers, budgeting priorities, large amounts of money being diverted from things that people actually need to now grapple with the Russia war, the Russia threat.
Well, billions of dollars were just poured into contractors' pockets after September 11th. Anyone that came forward and said that they had some thing that they could sell, some consulting they could sell, some item they could sell that was going to protect America from some, existential but not specified generalized threat, and that could be through, you know, intelligence, homeland security, anything. I mean, it's just a massive, massive funding machine, and we're going to see the same thing here. We are seeing the same thing here. And I think it's important, too, in recognizing this effort to shut down political speech on social media platforms and minimally to malign it and suggest that dissenting speech is a tool of a foreign government, is this is in the same context where in the last couple years we've seen bills being introduced by state legislatures all over the country that are criminalizing peaceful protests, that are threatening people with unheard of penalties. We've seen a whole new layer of felony prosecutions for affiliation with protests, even where people have not been engaged in any illegal acts, as anyone would recognize those acts. And at the same time, there's this new language that's being used, including by the New York Times, about weaponizing the First Amendment, that our fundamental, cherished First Amendment rights that have been enshrined through decades of hard-fought work by people on the streets and supporting legal organizations, that those rights are somehow being weaponized against American interests. And so we should turn our back on what the First Amendment allows, requires, provides, the rights that we hold. This is a very dangerous direction to take people in.
Yeah, Jim Kavanaugh, 30 seconds left. That's all through those hearings yesterday. The sort of concept, as Mara put it, of weaponizing free speech. The Russians are taking advantage of free speech. So what's the solution? Close down those free speech spaces, monitor them, regulate them, let the FBI guarantee that they're not being weaponized by our adversary. And as a consequence, people kind of just with through omission or commission, giving over to the FBI the power about speech itself. I took up 30 of your seconds, 20 seconds left. Go ahead.
Well, no, that's exactly right. And these companies, these media companies or platform companies, both, are ceding to the intelligence and police agencies, the FBI and the CIA, the authority and their arms in these Atlantic Council, the authority over them to guide them in what's permissible speech on their platforms. And it's really disgraceful. And this is what Clapper said. In fact, I think it was Clapper who said it about Julian Assange. Oh, he's taking advantage of the First Amendment. You can't really think that free speech is going to work for him and for this kind of stuff, you know, giving us information. So this is a whole Russiagate has become a war on dissent, American dissent, and a war on free speech.
That's what it exactly is. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She's a constitutional lawyer and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. You can go to her website at justiceonline.org. Justiceonline.org is the website. And we've been joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
So there's a lot going on, a lot to talk about. Paul, I want to start with you this week because you were involved in a deposition that ended just hours ago.
Yes, no, I just wrapped up a deposition, and that challenges the mail censorship policies of the Baxter County Jail in Arkansas, which unfortunately, like a lot of jails around the country, bans prisoners from getting all books, magazines, and letter mail from anyone.
And you've fought this issue for years. I remember that there was a prison in South Carolina that allowed only postcards to come into the jail, and so there was no reading material that was permitted.
Right, and that's exactly the situation here, where the jail bans prisoners from getting anything in the way of letter mail, all books, and all magazines. And this is their, you know, this is their policy. And so prisoners literally have nothing to read.
So unhealthy and dangerous.
Real quick, before we go to Kevin, Paul, let's talk about Vincent Gaines.
Yes. Yesterday, the Human Rights Defense Center, we filed a lawsuit in federal court in Tallahassee, hopefully seeking justice for Vincent Gaines. And Vincent was a mentally ill Florida prisoner. He was serving a 5-year sentence for burglary. And he basically was starved to death by the Florida prison system. He was around 5'10". He went into prison weighing 190 pounds. And by the time he died, he weighed 110 pounds. And basically, he was starved to death over a period of time by a prison system that has quite the reputation. And unfortunately, the sad reality is quite the track record for pretty callous brutality towards the prisoners in its care and captivity. And Darren Rainey was another prisoner. He was a mentally ill prisoner that was burned to death by Florida prison guards in another prison a couple of years ago. So we view Mr. Gaines' death as kind of a continuum of a system that routinely kills and brutalizes the prisoners in its custody.
Yeah, this is an ongoing theme in Florida, and not just Florida, but in other states too. I know that in the Prison Legal News magazine, Paul, you've covered a number of times issues like this case you just mentioned in Florida, where a prisoner was put in a shower and he was scalded there until he was dead, and his skin literally fell off of his body. And then, to the best of my recollection, none of the guards were charged in that death, or if they were charged, they were acquitted.
No one was charged. In some respect, that's even worse. They'd even go through the pretenses of a token prosecution, and that's exactly part of the that's part of the problem here, is that this level of impunity where guards and the supervisors routinely murder the prisoners in their care, and then there's no consequences for it. And part of the problem, too, is also part of the medical examiner. In the case of Darren Rainey, it took the medical examiner like 4 years to issue a finding in the case. And then she ruled that his death was an accidental homicide, and which is kind of like that kind of begs the question, well, accidental in what sense? They meant to torture him but not kill him? You know, and that I think is what some of is. Kind of, I think, what illustrates, I think, you know, kind of the whole problems, you know, with holding the American police state accountable at any level is that they routinely kill prisoners, and at the end of the day, no one's responsible.
Kevin, how does a prison authority starve a prisoner like Vincent Gaines? How do they do it? Starve them to death?
Well, I mean, they have no morality, basically. I mean, if that's the sort of callousness they can inflict on a human being, then in the most basic sense, it means that they have no humanity that's holding them back from engaging it. They've become part of a system where they're okay with inflicting that kind of pain. And then, you know, also, I think, again, as is a common theme for a lot of our shows, this is part of control. So you become okay with this sort of outcome because it sends a message to other prisoners and effectively spreads fear within a facility.
It's true. This is an ongoing problem, and people aren't stupid. People see, and when I say people, I mean prisoners around the country, see that there is no justice in cases like this. They have nothing to look forward to. They don't trust the courts. In many cases, they don't trust their own attorneys. And then at the end of the day, nobody is served. Justice is never served. I want to move on to something, Kevin. I just finished watching a video. It's a video of a hearing in Ohio where a prisoner is sitting in the courtroom with two of his attorneys at the table, and he's talking. He's talking to the judge. The judge doesn't like being spoken to and repeatedly tells the prisoner to shut his mouth and that he will tell him when he can speak. The prisoner continues to speak, and then six guards inside the courtroom hold this guy down, and they tape his mouth shut. I mean, that's a little thing. That's not being burned to death in the shower, but it's yet another indication that you just really have no rights when you're on the other side of the law.
It's also reminiscent of what happened to Bobby Seale in the Chicago 7 / Chicago 8 trial. Yeah, tape his mouth shut. Anyway, Paul, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say is that, you know, there's actually the more extreme examples that I think was also in Chicago a couple years ago was where the judge ordered a defendant to be quiet, and then ultimately seven or eight guards piled on top of him and killed him of positional asphyxia right there in the courtroom.
Unbelievable.
So he did shut up. They just killed him.
Yes, they did shut him up permanently. And as I recall, when there was a lawsuit filed over, and as I recall, what was really sickening about it was that the judge was deemed to have judicial immunity and thus could not be sued for having given the orders that led to the guy's death. And, you know, so I think there's just these, you know, but there's definitely a long pattern. There's also recently a video, I don't know if it made it onto the national news, but here in Florida kind of went viral, of a judge in Broward County telling an African-American woman who she was in jail on some really minor offense and just telling her to shut up. And then when her lawyer was trying to intervene as well, telling him to shut up, and it was caught on video. And it's just such a sickening performance that it just kind of really makes clear that, you know, for a lot of the actors in the American police state, the common citizenry, we're just fodder to be processed, as they pretty much make it pretty clear. We are the ruled, you know, and we have no say in any of this.
Kevin Gostella, I mean, it goes to the point that you're making. It's all about control. It's control, control, control. And also to make it clear who's ruling and who are the ruled. When you think about what we're taught as kids and what our children are taught now, a democracy of, by, and for the people. But we have all of these incidents, which at one time when you hear them, when you hear, oh, a prisoner starved to death, or a mentally ill prisoner burned to death, or a prisoner asphyxiated because they won't stop talking in court, and then they're just, you know, shut up permanently. When you hear about each of them, each one screams out as if it's an anomaly. But then as we keep talking and thinking and going over the actual patterns, it's not an anomaly. It may be extreme in terms of its outcome, but the issue of control of the ruling and the ruled, it's a dominant part of the system.
Yeah, that's an important general point to make. And I think specifically, I'd just like to quickly add in relation to this case with Franklin Williams in Ohio, he was, according to this news report, complaining about his representation. And that's definitely a problem that I think happens for a lot of accused, a lot of defendants who are going before, that they feel that their attorneys aren't appropriately representing them. I mean, I assume that or presume that Williams probably can't afford a very good attorney to represent him, like most people in the United States who go through the system. I presume that he probably had someone along the lines of a public defender or someone who was assigned to him because he could not afford a counsel. Just looking at what he's accused of and sort of his history and how he'd been in this situation before. And so trying to raise his voice and suggest to the judge that he wasn't getting good representation to be shut down is such a just really represents just how the system doesn't really care about your concerns about fair or due process, that in fact at the for the most part, it's going to cater to what prosecutors are doing.
We were talking amongst ourselves here yesterday in the studio about the fact that if your attorney falls asleep during trial, that's not grounds for appeal. And indeed, your attorney can fall asleep through most of the trial, and that's not grounds for appeal. I was in prison with one guy whose attorney fell asleep every day during his trial, and on the last day had a diabetic seizure, and that still wasn't grounds for appeal. There are a lot of bad attorneys out there, a lot. You remember the old cliche that half of all attorneys graduated in the bottom half of their class.
Well, you know, but I also think that the part of the problem with a lot of this stuff is these are almost all the problems of poor people that can't afford attorneys.
That's right.
And, you know, like one of the jokes, too, is that, you know, all the death penalty trials do is determine who's got the best or the worst attorney. And, you know, I think that those are all kind of like sad commentaries. But, you know, bigger issues that come up is when you talk about the sleeping lawyer, there's actually like a whole body of jurisprudence around sleeping lawyers. And there's also one about sleeping judges, too. And I think this almost raises the whole axiom about, you know, the good enough for government work is, you know, what the people expect, what constitutes adequate counsel and that. And, yeah, when you see the judges in courts going on, well, you know, just because the lawyer was asleep doesn't mean he wasn't effective. The Constitution just says you're entitled to a lawyer. Nothing says he needs to be awake. And I think in some respects, that's almost like an admission of the conveyor belt system of our criminal justice system is that, hey, it doesn't matter if the lawyer's awake, the outcome's pretty much a foregone conclusion. And I think these are kind of like some of the bigger issues that they don't really, you know, that I think kind of go unremarked. And then it also gets down to how much justice is good enough for poor people in this country.
I'm looking at the Chicago Tribune. Kevin is in Chicago. November 8th, 2017. That would be a year ago almost. The headline is, judges sleeping through evidence, not cause for new trial, Illinois appeals court says. If a judge falls asleep during a murder trial, should the defendant automatically get a new trial? A divided Illinois appellate court panel recently said no. So long as the judge was not dozing through crucial evidence or motions, an inadvertent nap is harmless. Quote, we find that a judge falling asleep during a trial does not constitute reversible order, Judge Daniel Schmidt wrote in the majority opinion. Again, you would think when you hear it, somebody's going to go to prison or possibly the death penalty. And you would think, okay, here's an anomaly. A judge fell asleep. And here's another anomaly. Somebody said, no, that's cool. And then it's not an anomaly because it happens a lot. And this is the appeals court in Illinois by majority opinion, not an anomaly, saying, yeah, that's cool. Go ahead, Kevin.
And the only thing I would have to add is just, we're not talking about traffic violations here. We're not talking about, you know, did somebody forget to signal when they were turning in an intersection? I mean, he's accused of a serious crime of robbery, you know, this case in Ohio. I mean, these other cases, I presume that they're facing serious allegations. You know, whether or not they committed the crime, the people who are involved in adjudicating this process, if they're not engaged, you know, there's no way that you can have any confidence that the outcome is the one that should be correctly handed down.
Yeah, these are people going to prison for life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or as you said, John, to death. I mean, Paul Wright, can a judge fall asleep in a capital case and that's cool too?
Yeah, I mean, sadly, there's a whole body of case law around that as well, where the courts have held that, you know, the judge dozing off. There's also been the cases where, you know, the judges are impaired. Those have all been held to be, you know, perfectly okay. Ironically, the corrupt judge, the judge that takes bribes, and then the guys who got the death penalty who didn't bribe them get the death penalty. That's been held to be grounds for the reversal of the death sentence. So, you know, so it's just interesting what happens. But, you know, I think we should also note that this is not relegated to criminal cases. I've personally been in appeals courts where I've been watching the oral arguments. Fortunately, it wasn't in the Human Rights Defense Center cases, but I was in a case in the Fifth Circuit a couple years ago waiting for oral argument in our case, And the case before us was a civil dispute between two oil companies over literally millions of dollars. And so I'm sitting there in the peanut gallery watching the proceedings, and one of the judges was clearly asleep. And he dozed through like the entire oral argument, you know, of the two oil companies. And I talked to one time to with a friend of mine. He's a corporate lawyer. He represents large corporations. And he told me that one of the big things that he has a problem is explaining to his clients is when he's representing them in these cases and they're having appeals involving cases involving hundreds of millions of dollars, and one of the judges is asleep. He says that's why he always tries to get cases argued in the morning and not in the afternoon after lunch. And he says his clients are like, you know, can you wake the judge up? And he has to tell him, no, that would be unseemly. And then he says it's really bad is when the judge who is asleep is the author of the opinion and his client loses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really shocking when you talk about it. What about jurors falling asleep? I mean, we have judges, jurors, prosecutors. I guess the prosecutors don't fall asleep much, but
they have their acts together.
Yes, we never hear about the sleeping prosecutor.
No, they're all, damn, they're always awake. An Illinois appeals court did order a new trial for a burglary defendant in 2006 after the trial judge noted that a juror was half asleep during almost the entire proceeding. Again, that would be perhaps more likely after lunch or after a night of hard drinking, perhaps the next morning, could be morning or afternoon. Again, you would think there would just be an absolute rule about this because, you know, people's fate. I mean, most people don't go to trial because they're afraid. They're afraid that if they go to trial, they're going to lose because the deck's stacked, unless you have like a multi-million dollar lawyer. So you don't go to trial. But the rare times where people actually say, I'm innocent, I want to go to trial, and then you have a sleeping judge, you have a sleeping juror or jurors, again, seems to be a fundamental thing, not a small thing.
I want to actually switch topics, if you guys don't mind. I want to talk about something that we've...
Was that making you go to sleep?
Yeah, it's very hot in this studio as well. we've spoken in the past about mental illness in prisons and the fact that there are more mentally ill people in prisons than there are in mental health facilities around the country. There was a suit that was filed in Sacramento County, California, by a group. It's a class action suit by a group of mentally ill prisoners. Kevin, I think you were the one covering this. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
So this development is just basically that the jail conditions in this facility are inadequate to provide for mental health care, and that basically these prisoners are being put in solitary confinement, and this is in fact the way in which the facility is managing these mentally ill or these individuals that have problems, mental health problems. And so I think like this is a very prevalent issue. We've talked about this on the show many times. And I think it's a really good step here that this disability rights group is stepping forward in order to challenge it, because, you know, for the most part, you see this. Unfortunately, I don't have anything off the top of my head, but I know that people who have been incarcerated, instead of dealing with their problems because there's either the doctor is not available or they have a limited amount or they just don't care, they don't make any arrangements in order to help individuals. You can have issues with people who are deaf. You can have blind prisoners too that sometimes get lumped in. And in this situation, the way that they manage them is putting them in appalling conditions. And I'd imagine that you could even see the use of medication, the abuse of medication in order to control these prisoners. So it's something that's really important for prisoners here in California to be challenging. And in Sacramento County, I'm sure that what's going on there is very similar to what's happening throughout the United States.
There's a paragraph in an article that was distributed by disabilityrightscalifornia.org that I think really lays this all out. It says here, Sacramento County locks up hundreds of people in solitary confinement where they spend nearly their entire existence alone in a cell. They may not get outside for fresh air or to see the sun for months at a time. Many are classified as total separation prisoners, meaning that they are not permitted to have normal contact with any other human beings. At least 5 people have died by suicide since November 2016, including 3 who were in total separation, and hundreds more have become suicidal or have engaged in acts of self-harm. I can't imagine that that is atypical of any of these types of facilities. This has to be going on in every other similar facility across the country with mentally ill prisoners and with inadequate mental health care. Paul, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think this is actually, unfortunately, the norm around the country is that medical care and mental health care is abysmally bad everywhere. It's not even, like, I can't think of a single prisoner jail I would say, if I were sick or ill, this is the place to be because you're going to get adequate medical care. They're all pretty much dismally bad. Same thing goes with mental health care. And I think that literally the only thing that the prisons and jails in this country are good at is physically caging people and preventing them from physically leaving. That's about it. Everything else, whether it's medical care, mental health care, rehabilitation, education, you know, you name it, they're pretty bad at. So, you know, I think that this is also pretty much the norm. And I think part of the problem, too, is that, you know, no one expects government officials to do these things well. No one's being held accountable over these issues. The only time people lose their jobs is if prisoners escape.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that someone's losing their job over. But prisoners being starved to death, burned to death, killing themselves, getting killed by other prisoners or staff alike, pretty much no one's losing their job over that stuff. It's just business as usual. Everyone's fine with it.
I'll tell you, when I was at FCI Loretto, the only 2 guards who lost their jobs while I was there was one who allowed an escape because he had left his post to go outside and pick up a pizza that he had ordered. And a prisoner walked away from the minimum security camp while he was away from his post. And there was a guard who was allowed to retire quietly after sexually assaulting prisoners in the walk-in cooler in the cafeteria. There's almost never fallout for these prisoners, except, as you say, Paul, when somebody escapes.
Yeah, and I don't think this is lost on the people running the prisons and jails in this country. You know, it's just, you know, as long as no one escapes, your job is pretty secure, so is your pension, and no one's expecting more than that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
I'd like to quickly add that they have a name for the solitary confinement. It's called total separation. Just very, like, macabre sort of term for what they're doing to these people. And yeah, they do this thing where they believe they have to protect, and I know that this happens across the U.S., but in this particular facility, what they're doing is they believe they have to protect these people who have these disabilities. And so, in effect, they're punishing them by putting them in solitary confinement. And they claim they're doing it. They can claim they're doing it for their safety. And you're in solitary confinement for 21 to 22 hours of the day. And it violates the American Disabilities Act. It flagrantly violates. And this facility, particularly in Sacramento County, has known it's violating this law for at least 3 or 4 years. The disability rights organization that put out that is suing Disability Rights California has done reports on this. And, you know, the step now is to sue because pointing out the inhumanity of what is being done is not good enough.
Absolutely right.
So that makes sense, too. And also, Paul, you alluded in the beginning to the issue of immunity. If you immunize judges, if you immunize police, which have qualified immunity is sort of a constantly used instrument so as to protect police who arrest people without probable cause, including, you know, large numbers of peaceful protesters. Qualified immunity is always the first trench there. How big of a factor does immunity play in all of that?
I think it plays a huge factor because I think that, you know, this is one of those things that, if you think about it, if you could sell drugs or kill people and never have to face any consequences for it, you know, I think you'd have a lot of people selling drugs and killing people. And I think this is, and when you talk about the killing people, that's exactly what happens with the police state in this country, is that you have police and jail guards and prison guards around the country. They routinely kill people, and they're never held accountable for it. They're never criminally prosecuted, and then they're never held civilly liable by having to pay damages. And typically, guards and policemen and that, they're all indemnified by the agencies that employ them. So even if they were held responsible and forced to pay damages, the money wouldn't come out of their pocket. It would just come out of the public treasury of our taxpayer dollars. But presumably, if the agencies are paying enough money, they would start weeding out these bad actors that are costing them money. But instead, they don't. A number of years ago, around 10 or 15 years ago, Human Rights Watch did a study, and it was pretty interesting because it found that, I think to no one's surprise, that 3-5% of cops led to like 80% of the judgments and litigation payouts against the agencies. And which is interesting because it kind of, I think, gave some empirical evidence to what I think a lot of us that are in the field kind of already know, is that, you know, a large majority of police officers and prison and jail guards are going to go through their entire career. They're never going to shoot anyone. They're never going to hurt anyone. And they're going to retire after 30 years. And they've never been sued. But then you've got that small percentage of actors that are going to kill a bunch of people. They're going to brutalize a bunch of people. And they're going to get sued a bunch of times. And then rather than saying, hey, we've got a problem here, they're using inappropriate force or whatever, the agencies tend to close ranks, they protect them, they vigorously defend them in civil court, and then the judges kind of collude in this by not holding them liable for damages, saying, well, you know, hey, you don't have to pay anything, someone's dead, but hey, it's all just a good, honest mistake, you know, no one's going to have to pay. And, you know, these are all, I think, this is kind of like one of the systemic issues that I think has perpetuated police misconduct and police abuse and abuses within our prisons and jails to no end, because I think that if the government entities that employ these people were held financially responsible, they would have an incentive to try to start fixing the problems. And as things stand right now, they have none.
They have none. We're going to have to leave it there. That was a great discussion. And I regret that we didn't have time to talk about prison reform measures, something that's very important. And there were actually developments this week. We can talk about that next week. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and editor of Prison Legal News Magazine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.